Hello, I'm Chris Cotterman, and I'm here with artistic director Tom DeLise, and we are going to tell you all about the Baltimore Shakespeare Factory 2019 season. Tom, welcome.
Well, thank you.
Happy New Year to you and to everyone. So we have quite a season, don't we?
I think we had a really good season of some very popular Shakespeare plays, often performed. And we also have a couple plays that aren't performed as often.
Yeah, we're taking two steps closer to completing the whole canon this year, right?
We are.
Because we're doing Cymbeline and Merry Wives of Windsor, which are BSF premieres.
Right, and that should take us to 23 of the 38.
And then Night of the Burning Pestle obviously hasn't been performed by us before either. So it's three brand new plays for us.
Right. So Night of the Burning Pestle is our Shakespeare Contemporary series production. And I love it. I think it's the funniest play ever written during the Elizabethan Jacobean period. Funnier than anything Shakespeare wrote.
Yeah. Shakespeare isn't the funniest to me, but I think a lot of his contemporaries were better at comedy. His comedies aren't like laugh out loud funny necessarily. I don't find them to be. they have their moments.
They have their laugh out loud moments, whereas Night of the Burning Pestle is pretty much laughing all the way through.
Yeah. So I guess before we talk a little bit about each play, is there anything that people can expect different at BSF this season? I know we've got significant improvements have been made to our stage since last time people have seen a show.
Yeah, the gentleman who had originally co-built the theater, Tom Brown, has done remarkable work in the last few months, making some incredibly beautiful improvements.
Yeah.
And there are a number of other things that he's going to do. He's telling me that the roof and the heavens with the astrological zodiac signs on them, I think, hopefully will be done by the time that we open Cymbeline. And then there's all kinds of other great things that he has planned that hopefully will be happening within this 2019 season. But it already looks absolutely gorgeous. And so it's a beautiful place to see a Shakespeare play. It's a perfect place to see a Shakespeare play.
So let's talk about the shows that we've got lined up. We'll just dive right into that. Because some of them, like you said, are really popular and aren't going to need a whole lot of discussion. But we're kicking off with Cymbeline, which is running February 15th through March 10th. And you're directing Cymbeline, Tom.
I am.
This is a play I've only seen once, so I don't know it as well as some of the others. And a lot of people might not know it at all. So what can you tell us about Cymbeline?
Well, Cymbeline is a play that was written very near the end of Shakespeare's career. It may have been the last, at least probably within the last three plays that he wrote, maybe the second to last one, by himself. And it's a play where Shakespeare seems to be taking every theme, every character type, every trope, and deciding to throw it all into one play. So it's very, very interesting on a number of levels. You will see, a number of echoes, if not downright duplications of things that Shakespeare did earlier in his career. We're going to do it with a little bit of a fairy tale spin because there are a number of fairy tale like stereotype characters, stereotypical situations. So that I think is going to be one thing that's pretty interesting. And also, again, hopefully, like all our plays, heavily audience interactive.
Mm-hmm. So what do you... that's an interesting thing you brought up, and it was something I wanted to touch on, so I'm glad you brought it up. What do you think are the things that set Shakespeare's later period works apart? Because I know it's like we did Winter's Tale a couple years ago, which is one of his later ones. We did Antony and Cleopatra is sort of one of towards the end of his career, right? But, Winter's Tale especially, and, like, Pericles, which we haven't done, and Cymbeline, and what is they have their own sort of unique flavor. What would you say that it is that makes them stand out from some of the early work?
Yeah, I mean, the last few plays that he writes are kind of fit into what are called the romance. They're called today the romances, for lack of a better category, other than comedy, history, tragedy. But they're more like tragicomedies, and that was actually the term, I think, that was used during Shakespeare's time to describe those types of plays. It was a term coined by John Fletcher, who was a co-writer with Shakespeare and took over as the playwright, the house playwright of the King's Men, and who did who was the author of The Sea Voyage, which we did in 2017.
With Philip Massinger.
With Philip Massinger, yeah.
Let's not leave Philip out.
We won't leave old Phil out. But if I had to answer it in one word, I would say that that one word is the thing that really seems to be a theme that was really heavily in Shakespeare's mind was the idea of forgiveness, the idea of pardon. In this play, right near the end of the play, Cymbeline says, pardon is the word for all. There's some egregious things that are done in this play, and yet they are pardoned. The Tempest, the same thing.
Right.
You know, Prospero pardoning his brother and everybody who was involved in the plot to overthrow him.
Winter's Tale
heavily factors in. Antony and Cleopatra.
Yeah.
Even. Not in the same kind of way, but, you know, Antony forgives Cleopatra for supposed duplicity and stuff like that. And even Lear, you know. Cordelia's incredible capacity for forgiveness. So I think it was something that was on Shakespeare's mind in the very end of his writing career. So, you know, there's been all kinds of speculation as to why that was something that was on Shakespeare's mind. But the simple fact is, no matter what you read, we'll never know.
Right.
But we know it's very heavily present in these plays. And again, in Cymbeline, it is. It's a big factor at the end.
And this is when he was almost sort of falling out of favor as a writer, correct? You know, towards the end of his career, where he was sort of being, you know, replaced by the new guard in a way, right? Like the plays of Fletcher and were more favorable to the public. And
yeah, I think I've read this before, and some scholars believe that, and I don't know if that's true or not, but it seems to me that Shakespeare was attempting to kind of hone in on some of the key dramatic innovations of the theater at that time. Just one example would be the concept of the mask.
Mm-hmm.
And so Ben Jonson was famous for all these masks. And the court of King James I, you know, the king's men, Shakespeare's sponsor, loved masks. And Jonson wrote a number of them along with Inigo Jones that were very, very popular. And so we see other playwrights at the time using these masks. Shakespeare, to me, seems to make kind of a half-hearted attempt to just throw a mini mask in there just to say, look, I did it. You know, we see it in The Tempest. We see it in Cymbeline. We see it in Pericles.
Mm-hmm.
Is there one in Winter's Tale?
There's that rustic dance sort of.
Yeah.
That's not quite a mask.
That's not really a mask. Yeah. So it's not in Winter's Tale. But, you know, in some of those plays at the end, he's throwing those almost obligatory masks in there. I don't think they're very well done. And a lot of people don't even realize them because in many times in productions, they're cut.
Mm-hmm. But you're not cutting it.
No. And it's not really a mask as such as it's a heavily intervention. It's Jupiter descending from heaven on the back of an eagle.
Yeah.
So our audience isn't disappointed. You will not see that part of it. You will see Jupiter, but he will not be descending from the heavens on the back of an eagle.
We're not getting an eagle?
No.
Oh.
Not
no.
unless our managing director, Ann Turiano, can arrange for millions of dollars
for a giant eagle
to produce the big eagle and the high hydraulic system that we would need to lower him from the rafters.
Well, I look forward to seeing how it's accomplished. That's a pretty bonkers scene in that play. I remember from when we saw it. The one time I saw it. It's pretty weird. I like Shakespeare's later day things. I think it's some of his best writing. But
I think Cymbeline is a fabulous play that is neglected. And I think it's neglected in large part. There are a number of influential scholars. At the head of them was Samuel Johnson, who just absolutely ripped the play. And a lot of people feel like it's not a good play.
They're wrong.
They are wrong. They absolutely are wrong. I'll be the first to say there are certain Shakespeare plays I don't like that much and that I don't think are particularly well done, but I would not classify Cymbeline as one of those.
We have gone all this time without even mentioning what one of the things that sets it apart is that it has a very large and very well written part for a woman, Imogen, I guess. How are you doing it?
We're going with the first folio.
And Imogen.
Yeah, be damned at what everybody else
is. Yeah. But one of like the great lead roles that Shakespeare wrote for a woman character.
Yeah, absolutely. It's a fabulous role.
Cymbeline actually is the title character, but is relatively small. In the scope of like the lines.
Yeah, you know. And scene appearances and stuff like that.
And when they did this at the Globe, they renamed it Imogen, right?
They may have. I didn't know that.
Recently, yeah, I think.
Yeah, 700 lines, I think, roughly is what Imogen has.
Which is on par with something like Berune or that's more than like The Bastard and King John. I'm just trying to think of ones that I know.
I think it's the second most. I think Rosalind and As You Like It has the most.
Yeah, she has a lot.
I'm not really sure. But
Imogen's
up there.
Imogen's a better character.
Imogen's a much, much better character.
Sorry, Rosalind fans. Well, moving right along, I guess I'll reiterate the dates. February 15th through March 10th is Cymbeline. And you can find all this information on our website. Follow us on social media. But I'm really excited about Cymbeline because I think it's a great play, like Tom said. And it's not one we've done. And so I'm really looking forward to it.
I am too.
Up next after that is one we have done before. But this time we're doing it in original pronunciation. And that is Hamlet.
Yes, and you're directing that.
I am directing that.
So why don't you tell us about that?
Oh, God. What is there to say about Hamlet that people haven't said already? So one of the things that I did, what you might not know, and I think we've touched on this in conversations Tom and I have had on these podcasts before, is we take a lot of care putting our versions of the script together.
Right.
Together. Hamlet's one of those tricky ones because there are essentially three extant versions of the script of Hamlet that are, vary from minorly different to dramatically different.
Oh, yeah.
There was a quarto published in Shakespeare, not too long after the play would have premiered. So that's known as Quarto One. Some people call it the bad quarto. There's the first folio published posthumously. And there's a second quarto, which is 400 or 500 lines longer than the first folio. The first folio is somewhere in between the first quarto is really short. I think it's like 800 lines shorter than the second quarto.
And I think they were only published like a year apart. I know the first quarto definitely was 1603.
Yeah.
And then I think the second quarto was 1604.
Mm-hmm.
And you got two dramatically different plays published like within a 1 to 2 year period.
Yeah.
And then the folio comes in and, like you say, kind of bridges the gap a little bit. But still way more lines than the first folio.
Yeah. And then, there are theories preferring one version or the other depending on who you listen to, they're all perfectly valid, but when there's no distinct version, I would say a lot of times people are most familiar with probably the second quarto is the version that gets produced or read the most, certainly in school. If you've read Hamlet in school, it's probably been the second quarto, I would say. Would you say? You're the one that is an English teacher.
Yeah, probably most of the ones that we've used in the schools I've worked at have used the folio.
Oh, really?
But then they will add in things like the seventh soliloquy by Hamlet, which doesn't appear in the folio, but appears in the second quarto. So they will, add some stuff in. But if you are looking to kind of work backwards, the second quarto is where you go.
Mm-hmm.
And then you can just cut back.
Yeah.
To where you want to be.
And there were word changes and line changes throughout that. So basically, in a long story short, this is the version that we cobbled together. cobbled together from all three versions of the play. So there are things that you will not be familiar with in this version. There are things that are the to be or not to be speech is probably in a different place than when we did it last time. Did you have it in the second quarto position?
I had it in the folio order.
Okay, so it'll be the same this time. But a lot of places produce it with it later in the play.
Yeah.
In the second quarto position. For those of you who aren't, obsessive about Hamlet's text, this might not mean a lot to you. But for those of you who are, this will be a unique version, which I think in a lot of respects, every version of Hamlet is unique because it is, which version are you doing? And what are you taking from each different version? And and why, and what do they mean? And so I think that's exciting.
No, it is. And again, that of all Shakespeare's plays, there's the play that you could probably say that every time it's done, it's never been done that way before.
Yeah. Yeah.
Because of all the different ways you can cut it, the different versions you start with, the different substitutions that you could make along the way. But yeah, so Hamlet's, you know, one of the challenging ones. And later on this year, when we're doing Romeo and Juliet, there's kind of the same challenge there because there are different quarto versions.
And Lear, doesn't Lear have...
Lear has, wow, yeah.
Two or three different versions.
Two or three different ones, and two are almost distinctively. A lot of complete works of Shakespeare now are putting in the different versions of the same play. Like, you'll find two King Lears.
Doesn't one have a happy ending?
No, not really, no. That was...
But that was one of the sources,
Nahum,
right?
Tate.
Oh, yeah.
Years later after the Restoration.
Right. Yeah. So, Hamlet, and, you know, we were talking about... Yeah, Hamlet, it's tricky to just to put a version together, but then to get it cut down.
Yeah.
Because, you know, we do try to keep everything, you know, around the orbit of 2 hours. And that's our goal this year.
Yeah, it's going to be a tough one.
Yeah, because we have three really long plays, but, you know.
Yeah, Cymbeline is one of the longest plays,
and
too, in Romeo
Hamlet
and Juliet.
And Romeo and Juliet. Yeah. But I'm aiming for, like, 215 with Hamlet.
Good.
And I know you're doing the same with Cymbeline, yeah. Right? Yeah. So, but yeah, Hamlet is 3,800 lines, so I tried to cut it down to 25. So it'll be, I think I mentioned this to you. When I was cutting it and reading it, it is a play that I think should be fast, because I don't think it's a play where anybody's ever has time to think.
Well,
or has time to have come up with and you know, orate about things that are I think it's all people thinking on their feet.
No, and I think you're absolutely right, and that hopefully will make our Hamlet better than most places that you see it, because many places where you do go, you know, one of the big things about Hamlet is that many interpretations involve the idea that Hamlet's a procrastinator.
Mm-hmm.
And so if you're choosing to have Hamlet as a procrastinator, you have him ponder things at a very slow pace, and the play can drag on. So I'm excited to see the pace of Hamlet.
Me too. We haven't started rehearsal yet. So, but I think it's fast, and I hope it'll be exciting and fast and something new and an original pronunciation.
Absolutely.
Only the second production in original pronunciation, I think.
I believe it's only the second one.
This is the first OP show we've done that has been done in OP before in the modern era. So,
what's our fifth one, isn't it?
Fifth.
Wow. Time's flying.
We're up there in the world.
Yep.
So that brings us to... So that's Hamlet. I'm sorry if I didn't mention it. It's April 12th through May 5th. Again, all this is on our website, but those are the dates. After that is Romeo and Juliet, another play that doesn't really need a lot of introduction. This one's exciting sort of for a reason, is because it's the first show that's going to be directed by one of our company members. Not the first show directed by a company member, but the first show directed by this particular company member, Anne Hammondtree, who listeners may know as seen her as Julius Caesar with us, and last summer as Constance in King John. She's going to be directing R&J for us. So I'm not sure what she has planned. But
no, I haven't had the director's meeting with her yet. But
I like Romeo and Juliet. It's a play that I think gets a... I think it's a play that gets a bad rap because it's poorly produced often, or it's read in high school and taught by teachers that don't care about it necessarily, and it's a play that everybody has some exposure to, and a lot of that exposure isn't positive. So I think people tend to look down on it, but I think it's a really good play.
It is, and I think it's just been over, not overproduced, but I mean, it's produced a lot. And it's in culture, so heavily, along with Hamlet, so heavily ingrained into our culture, you know, that you see references to Romeo and Juliet so often in television commercials or on TV shows and in movies, and people are called a Romeo, you know, and, you know, what was that one cell phone commercial where they did the whole play like in 15 seconds?
I don't know if I saw that.
A few years ago. It was really funny. It was really good. But I think, you know, people almost get tired of it sometimes.
Yeah.
And I know that when I directed it, I was like, well, okay. I was even trying to find another person to direct it. I taught it in school so many times. I'm like, oh, Romeo and Juliet. But once you get caught up in it, it's a fabulous play. And, you know, I think we have a unique way of doing plays. So I think our Romeo and Juliet will be very interesting to our audience and different than what they normally experience when they see a Romeo and Juliet.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean, one of the things that always has struck me about it is the just dramatic shift in tone, which is just is crazy. It starts as a comedy and turns into a tragedy. It's really funny.
It is, and I've said this over and over again. It was my opening speech every time I taught Romeo and Juliet. And when I was a high school teacher, was I would say to my students, okay, Shakespeare, school boards knew what was in Shakespeare,
yeah,
he would be banned.
Yeah.
And of all the plays that Shakespeare wrote, Romeo and Juliet, you could really make an argument that it was the dirtiest play he ever wrote.
Yeah.
And so from that standpoint, I always told my students, don't worry, I'm going to teach you all the dirty parts. So that got them interested kind of right away. It's a fabulous play. It's a story of young love, which makes it supposedly appealing to young people. But it's really not that. It's so much more than just a story of two young lovers.
Yeah, it's also the story about the bad advice they get from older people.
Exactly.
The terrible adult influences in their lives.
Absolutely.
It's like I said, what is there else to say about Romeo and Juliet other than... I think it's great, and I'm sure Anne will do a terrific job with it.
Absolutely.
So that's June 29th through July 20th. Following that is another play we have not produced, The Merry Wives of Windsor, which is running from July 26th to August 18th, and this is Shakespeare's third Falstaff play.
It is Shakespeare's third Falstaff play, and this isn't like Cymbeline, but probably way more so than Cymbeline, is a play... Merry Wives is a play that is just constantly ripped by critics who consider it, if you probably ask Shakespeare scholars to vote on what was the worst play Shakespeare ever wrote, mm-hmm. I think Merry Wives would win. But I don't agree with that at all. I think Merry Wives of Windsor is a hilarious play. If you're looking to have a good time.
Yeah, it is really funny.
It's an extremely funny play.
It's probably his funniest comedy, I think.
It is. You could say that. You really could say that. There are some incredibly funny situations. And, I think it's very much like at least American, maybe even British, sitcom.
Yeah.
The main reason it's criticized is because Falstaff is not the Falstaff of the Henry IV plays.
No, not at all.
He doesn't have that depth of character. He doesn't have that soul of a character. He's very superficial in this play. But you can argue the Merry Wives are the main characters in this play.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that would be a really good argument. And they're just a really great cast of characters that are, and funny situations and funny characters that I think is just an enjoyable night of theater.
Yeah.
I equate it in many ways to Midsummer Night's Dream.
Yeah.
You don't have any really... deep, this is not one of these plays that you're going to watch and you're going to go into a bar after it and have deep philosophical conversations about what Shakespeare was trying to say.
Mm-hmm.
You're just going to have a good time. It's not going to have the soaring poetry that Midsummer has because it's written almost totally in prose. And so the play's been given a really, really bad rap. You don't see it done very often. But I think it's a really good little... piece of theater.
And that's a good point that you raised, that the women really are the main characters. They're the title characters. They're really good, strong characters. And the the apocryphal story behind this is that Queen Elizabeth saw Henry IV Part 1 and 2 and wanted to see a play about Falstaff and love, and she wanted to see it in a fortnight.
Right.
And so Shakespeare had to scramble. But, he didn't write Falstaff and love. He wrote The Merry Wives of Windsor. So,
He did, and Falstaff really was not in love.
No,
Falstaff was in lust.
Yeah, and so I think Shakespeare was aware of what he was doing, and he was, taking that idea that, I'm going to take this famous character that people want to see, and I'm going to, I'm not going to make the play about him, I'm going to make the play about him getting an ass made out of himself the entire time.
Yeah, what I'll say about that real simply is that, Shakespeare may have considered himself a playwright. He probably wouldn't have called himself that. He would call himself a poet.
Mm-hmm.
But above all, Shakespeare was a man of the theater. Shakespeare had a great sense of the theater, mm-hmm. and what made it work. And that is what I think is the strongest quality of Merry Wives of Windsor. It's a great theater piece.
Mm-hmm.
It's a great way to come and spend 2 hours watching a play where you're going to laugh, you're going to have a good time, and you're going to walk out with a smile on your face.
And there's lots of cheese jokes.
Yeah. And nobody's offended, and you know what I mean? And it's great. It's a great play.
It's a fun one. So that's July 26th through August 18th, Merry Wives of Windsor. Which brings us to the last play of our season, The Night of the Burning Pestle by Francis Beaumont, November 1st through November 24th. I don't know this one. I haven't read it. So you tell us about it. I know it's filthy.
Well, think of the title.
Yeah.
Okay, it's right away an allusion to venereal disease. But it is really a fabulously funny play. I've seen it a couple times, and it is really just hilarious from beginning to end. I chose it for a number of reasons. It has some good female characters in it that I think are very interesting. It also has, it's very meta-theatrical.
Yeah.
What happens is this grocer and his wife, George and Nell, with their apprentice, Rafe, break in on a performance of a play called The London Merchant. And then they right away take seats on the stage and begin to take over the show. And they begin to take their apprentice and put him into the play as this knight to rescue a fair maiden. So it's constantly slipping in between the performance of The London Merchant and this grocer and his wife and their apprentice, Rafe, interrupting the play, suggesting possible scenarios, creating characters on the fly. And so it's a really, really fun piece of work that I think fits our performance style really well, because we emphasize strongly the idea of audience interaction. And so here's a perfect example of the audience interaction that went on in Shakespeare's time.
Yeah.
Probably way more so than what really went on. But, you know, the literature of the period, Ben Jonson in particular, is famous for writing prologues that literally say to the audience, stay in your seats,
right.
Be quiet.
Right.
You know, don't walk in front of us while we're acting. Yeah. You know, and so...
he would write that. Don't open your candy.
He was a stuffed shirt.
Yeah.
But Night of the Burning Festival just throws all of that on its head. And I think it's a fabulous play that I think audiences will really, really like.
Yeah, it's one that I know the name of, and I know like the concept behind it, but I just had never read it. So, hopefully... other people will have heard the name too, and you know, that will get people looking. But yeah, I think all of the contemporaries we've done have been great plays. You know, I think that's one of the cool things about doing the contemporaries is it. I mean, they're all plays that are the kind of plays that Shakespeare didn't write.
Yeah,
you know, we haven't done Tamburlaine yet. All the ones we've done are like art styles that Shakespeare didn't really touch, like the city comedy or these really kind of like meta theatrical send ups of like courtly romance. Like, you know, Shakespeare didn't really do that, and so I think it's cool because it brings a different perspective on the theater of the time and on, you know, on Shakespeare. Why did he write the things he did? Like, you know.
Yeah, that's why we do it. You know, we do the Shakespeare contemporaries for a couple of reasons. One is that, you know, like you just said right now, you know, what kind of light does it shine on Shakespeare's work? You know, when we went back and did the Shoemaker's Holiday, it was our first ever Shakespeare contemporary. You look at a character like Simon Eyre, and you can see comparisons to Falstaff.
Yeah,
you know, and that's a play that's written shortly after Shakespeare writes the Henry IV plays. The Sea Voyage is kind of a send-up of The Tempest, you know, and A Chambermaid in Cheapside is a London city comedy. It's like the ultimate London city comedy, which, you know, Shoemaker's had a lot of those traits, too.
Mm-hmm.
But this one, it's in a sense a London city comedy, but it's a real great play to see something that Shakespeare never attempted to do.
Yeah.
In a lot of ways.
Yeah.
So... that's one of the reasons we do it. And the other reason that we do the Shakespeare contemporaries is that there are some good plays out there written during that time by people that were not named Shakespeare. And those plays are really just overshadowed these days by Shakespeare. He has this iconic stature that... and I guess the other reason, which we hate to say, is it's challenging for a theater company to do one of these plays and draw an audience. People know Shakespeare. They know his titles. They know what to expect. You know, Shoemaker's Holiday. My goodness. who's ever done that one?
Right.
You know? And it was a great play.
Yeah, it is a great play.
It's my favorite of all the Shakespeare contemporaries that we've done so far, and most of the ones that I've read, and we have planned. So I think they're great little plays, and we want to shine a light on those and learn something about Shakespeare and his time at the same time.
Yeah. Well, Night of the Burning Pestle will give you the opportunity to do that November 1st through November 24th. That's it. That's our season. I think it's great. I'm looking forward to everything.
Yeah, I know. When I mention our season to some people, people really seem to like the season and think it's a really good season. We just had a board meeting the other night, and the board was really pleased to hear the season. And the next one, which we won't talk about now,
we'll save that for later.
But we think we have a great next season coming up, too. So
yeah.
We've got some great stuff happening in Baltimore Shakespeare Factory.
We do, and so we're very excited to share it with you. So, all the information for those shows is on our website. We have season tickets available for our shows. All that you can find online, baltimoreshakespearefactory.org, which is probably where you're listening to this, so I think you're already there. But if not, that's where to find us. And Tom, thanks for talking to me.
Yeah, I just have one more thing I want to mention.
Sure.
We have a series called Bard to the Bone Society.
Yes. Yeah.
And we have meetings on every other month. They're always an odd-numbered month, so coming up, I think on the 23rd, 4th of January, we have our first Bard to the Bone of this year, and it will be about Cymbeline.
Yeah, so.
So if you don't know much about Cymbeline, and you would like to come in and learn a little bit about Cymbeline, and actually sit in for about half an hour on a Cymbeline rehearsal, then that would be a great thing to do. We serve some wine and beer and soft drinks and cheese. It's all free. It's about 2 hours, 7 to 9.
Yep.
And all of them are listed on our website. So we have some interesting topics this year that deal with Shakespeare. And if you want to come to see Cymbeline, that would be great. It would be a great little introduction to Cymbeline if you're not that familiar with it. And a great way to actually come in, watch the cast a little bit, and get an idea of what the production will be like. So come and see a Bard to the Bone Society.
Yeah, yeah. Like Tom said, the schedule's on the website. So check it out and do come. It is free and it's fun. There's you can get some behind the scenes looks at the shows and learn something new. All right. Well, that's it for us. So thank you so much for listening, and we do hope that we see you at the shows.